Good morning. It's Friday, February 14th, a triple holiday, the last day of the Spring Festival, Valentine's Day, and today it's our birthday. The conversation turns three. We'll celebrate with a little sweet stuff and see if one manufacturer thinks Hawaii chocolate and industry belong in the same sentence.
But not all is hearts and flowers for many women and children. We'll get a preview of Hawaii's part in the 1 Billion Rising global event to spotlight domestic violence. Then a director's insight on a new stage adaptation of children's classic, Tales of Peter Rabbit.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkook.
Stay here for the conversation. First, this news. And we're celebrating here this morning. Everybody, now you have to stop dancing. We have a show to do. Good morning, Chris Vanderkook.
Good morning, Beth Ann, and happy birthday. Let me be one of the first to say it anyway.
And happy anniversary to you.
That's right. That's what it is.
It is. 3 years ago today, we started this show, and that'll come up now and again in the next hour. But as we're talking about dancing, let's get going here with our first conversation. Now, you may have some hot plans for tonight. Well, so do people in 207 countries around the world. In places where it's already tonight, they are in fact dancing, and not just for the pure joy of it. From Delhi to downtown Honolulu, they say they're coming together for a global dance party to raise awareness of violence against women and children and to seek justice. Holly Holowak is the event producer for the Hawaii contribution, which will happen tonight at Magic Island, and she joins us by phone now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann, and happy birthday and happy anniversary.
Thank you so much. And obviously, you've been scurrying around since even earlier this morning than you'd probably care to talk about. But this event has been steadily growing in Hawaii as it's been steadily growing around the world. Let's talk about it a little bit. It was started by Eve Ensler, the late playwright, best known for the Vagina Monologues. And in 2007, people were asking her, why would you start a dance party? And she seemed to address the paradox of dancing to raise awareness. Do you remember a little bit of what she said?
Yeah, sure, I do. She said that dancing is a revolution. It takes up space. It requires you to just fill the whole room with your energy, and it's very freeing. And she found it as an empowering way to help women stand up and rise for themselves.
There's no denying the joy that one usually feels when you're dancing, but trying to apply that joy to raising awareness of people who have been assaulted and who have not had justice for those assaults. Do you find that there's any sort of disconnect in there, despite what Eve Ensler said?
Actually, a lot of people have discussed that with me. Like when I tell them I'm doing a great event, they get all excited. And then when I tell them it's to raise awareness to end violence against women and children, their faces drop like what? And, you know, it is kind of a disconnect, but not when you finally really look at what we're doing, then you get it. There's a fabulous song that we dance to that's called our anthem. It's called Break the Chain. It was written by Grammy Award-winning Tina Clark. And it gives you the chicken skin. It's just such a great song. And it's uplifting. It's exciting. It makes you want to get up and say, I am beautiful. Sisters, rise with me. Let's get together and make something happen here. And it just encourages you to get up. And then you've got Debbie Allen, who is one of the top choreographers we have in our country, and she created a wonderful dance for it. And everybody can do it. It's not a very hard dance. It's kind of a hip-hop, Zumba-type dance, and it's just a lot of fun to do. And when I first found out about it, it was last Valentine's Day. They did their first 1 Billion Rising globally, and I was surprised when I saw it on Facebook, actually, on the YouTube videos that were coming in from around the world, how many millions of people knew about this already and were dancing and were joyful. And it just, it raises the bar when you start thinking about it. So even though it might seem like a disconnect, I think it really empowers women. And those that are still suffering, we're there for them. We're rising for them. We're letting the world know we're not going to take this anymore. Women cannot be the victims of constant brutality in countries around the world.
When you have a coming together globally, as is happening today,
yes.
And certainly people can go online and see what's already been happening around the world. There are live video feeds from all over the world.
Yeah, very exciting.
And also hear the song and all that. We'll have links to all of that on our Facebook page and on the website, too.
Wonderful.
But when you look at all of this stuff as it's been happening, and say, okay, there's one thing when you get together and there's almost like that conference high. Everybody is out to do something. It feels good in the moment. And then there's the next day.
Right.
And the next day.
Right,
and the
right,
next
right,
day.
Right.
Has there been a real connection to changes in policy and women taking action as a result of a 1 billion rising?
Well, I think so, because I wasn't involved last year and look where I am today. But I think overall, part of what we're trying to do is talk about it. And your show and the conversation is exactly what we're trying to do. If we don't end the silence, we won't end the violence. So we need to begin to talk openly about what's going on. It's not just something happening behind closed doors. It's affecting everybody, all your neighbors. 1 in 3 women will be sexually assaulted or abused in her lifetime. 1 in 3. I was somewhere with 3 women, and we were walking around, and we were handing out flyers, and we were talking to a man. And he said, really, 1 in 3? And he kind of laughed about it. He went, 1, 2, 3? And he said, really? And I just said, yes. And he didn't know that the woman standing next to me had been abused violently. And so he just assumes that it's not that bad. But it really is, and we're not going to change anything until we all start to face this and say, what can we do? How can we improve this? So talking about it is one thing. Dancing about it is for the moment, of course. But then sending it out on Facebook, sending it out on the internet, sending it out and saying, sister, I'm here for you. I'm rising for you. I'm going to do what I can to help you. Even if it's a small thing, I'm doing something. You're not alone. And so my whole point of this event is to give hope. Hope to those sisters who can't come out, who are still suffering, who are still trying to figure out how to get away from this abuse. And people around the world, there's things, mutilations and things happening around the world that I won't even get into because it's just too heartbreaking.
But don't we need to be talking about those things
and
be able to look at that and address it with policy? I mean, there are places in the world where it's still, you're still a criminal if someone finds out that you're homosexual, let alone if you've been assaulted and automatically have the assumption made that it was somehow your fault.
Exactly. Well, that's so true. And I think that not all Americans, but most Americans are progressive and are moving forward and saying, wait, this is not okay. And we just have to start somewhere. And so the more people that can look at this and start to, like, for example, after I got involved in this and I started planning what I was going to do, I've been working on this literally since February 14th last year. On February 25th, I had my first committee meeting, and I had the permit for the place started. You know, I had reserved the location for Magic Island. And so the whole year, though, because of that, I've been noticing and focusing and seeing TV shows about it. They had something on, I can't remember the name of the show at night, but it was these 2 women from Iran that were talking about the travesties that have been happening over there, and one lady from Iraq, and telling us how women are now being raped and abused at alarming statistics. And it's just, you know, because I got involved, I'm seeing things, and it empowers me more to want to do more.
It's really changed your focus. Well, we wish you all the best
there
on Magic Island tonight, and we'll check back with you. And we'll have all the information on our Facebook page and also on the HPR2 website.
Great. It's a free event. We've got super entertainment.
We've got all of it down. We got to go, Holly. Sorry. Thanks very much for joining us. That was Holly Holowak. She's the event producer for 1 Billion Rising Honolulu. And in her daily life, she's the director of Weinberg Village Waimanalo, a transitional housing program for homeless families. Again, more about $1 billion with a B rising is on HPR2.org.
At 8:14, this is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. Coming up, a new take on beloved children's classics comes to the HTY stage.
Mau, ukahoolabe, uhamay.
As we've been talking about throughout the last 15 minutes, well, in some way or other today, The Conversation is celebrating our third anniversary, and so we thought we'd test your memory to see if you can recall our very first show on Valentine's Day 2011. It was a Monday. It was pretty excited, and we were pretty excited. I don't know what that was. That just made me very excited. Also, a little nervous about all the pieces and hoping that they would work. Love was on the agenda in many ways and in the range of topics as we began to talk. Well, we know that many of you have been listening since the very beginning. And so for today's quiz, can you name any of the conversations that we had that morning? Yeah, we know it's tough, but we bet you got this one covered. If you can, post your answer on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, and we'll see who has a good memory, even if it's just us, a little later in the show when we tell you the answers.
Aloha, I'm Brooke Wilson from Bernice Pauahi Bishop Museum. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
Young kids need no encouragement to be curious. They're that way about everything. But how do you channel that curiosity and translate it into a lifelong love of learning? Those are some of the questions at the heart of playwright and director Annie Wood Cusick's work. She's adapted two Peter Rabbit stories for the Honolulu Theater for Youth. Peter Rabbit is one whose curiosity could get the better of him, and his story could give kids something to think about. Annie has created Peter Rabbit and the Garden for very young children, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Annie.
Good morning, and happy birthday.
Wow, thank you. You know, the audience of very young children, this has kind of become a specialty of yours, hasn't it?
You know, it's an audience I absolutely adore doing work for, and one that I feel is a huge responsibility to treat with such care, you know. And when I went to see the show the other day, it was at St. Anthony's School in Kailua, and I watched the kids walking into their cafeteria,
mm-hmm.
and they were, well, actually it wasn't the cafeteria, it was like a kind of the gym hall, and they were just, first of all, they were sort of transported because they were walking into what was normally a big empty room, and there was this set there,
mm-hmm.
and their faces were just magical, like, wow. And I thought, wow, it's so exciting, because you could do a play in the theatre, and they walk in and they go, okay, there's a light, there's a stage, that's what we're going to look at. But go into their school, take it into, if it's their cafeteria or their gym hall or their classroom or their patio,
mm-hmm.
it's a wonderful thing to see them transported to a different place. And I love it. I think going to their venues is really important at such a young age, because they're not frightened, you know, they're in a safe environment. And I've seen kids come in the theatre and just start to cry because it's dark,
or
it's loud, and they don't know where it is, or they don't really know where they're meant to be looking, especially that young, or they've never been there before. And what are all these other people doing there as well, you know?
Yeah.
So for the very young audience members, it's really lovely to go into their space. And yeah, when they came in the other day, I just watched their faces watching the show.
Well, and going into their space and transforming that space. I mean, that's a kind of a fundamental lesson about what theater does, isn't it?
Yeah, and just not just transforming the physical space, which we do beautifully, and but transforming what goes on emotionally in that space. You know, like the laughter and the giggles and the fun that they have is so wonderful to see. And you know, when I was asked if I would do Peter Rabbit, I was like, well, how do I make these stories? How do I move these stories from being essentially, they felt like bedtime stories. I mean, they're beautiful, they're gentle, and then they go to bed with a cup of chamomile tea. How do I make that a fun thing for a child? And so they don't just think, okay, it's time to go to sleep now. So I drew on the fact that Beatrix Potter, although she's 99 years older than me, I mean, I just think that's amazing as well, that here I am, you know, a woman 100 years on doing her work and presenting it. She was very, very English, and that kind of tickled me, because you know, I'm very, very Scottish, and I thought, well, she's very, very English, let's do something really beautiful here. So Mrs. Rabbit in our play, I've kind of modeled her on Beatrix Potter. So Peter's mum is very Beatrix-like, and very, like, you know, uses the same kind of language. And Mr. McGregor, he's a real fun character. I think in the stories, she doesn't say he's Scottish, but I made him very Scottish, and I had great fun with that and training the actor to be have a brilliant Scottish brogue as well.
What do you think are the, when you say she's very English, what are the qualities that you stand out by the way?
Very particular, very precise, very gentle, and she's a well-educated woman, and... gosh, yeah, very
There's
English.
A very That's distinctive, I mean, anybody who has read those stories as a child remembers a very distinctive tone to the Peter Rabbit stories.
You know, maybe it's to do with the watercolors and the painting as well. Mm-hmm. And
But you feel as if you know her, the author, I think, from reading those stories, don't you think?
The way that she writes is, she doesn't just write the story, she's right in there with it. You know, she'll say, well, I wouldn't have liked that to be there at all, even though the rabbit did, you know. So she comments on it, and she's right in the middle of the story. And that's very, very funny, you know. I love that a lot. So, you know, we have a little moment where Mrs. Rabbit is definitely right there in it as well. And it was great fun, and, you know, creating it for the Hawaii kids, you know, because we have, you know, English accent, the Scottish accent, and we have this world, and I've used the, you know, English
Morning,
music
Chad.
And Scottish music.
How are you?
So we have, you know, actually English Country Garden is a kind of classic English song, and that starts the show.
Sure.
But yeah, Peter is a curious little rabbit, and he goes into Mr. McGregor's garden, even though he's told that he could face death when he goes in there, because it could be made into a rabbit pie. And we have a really...
Very much like a little kid.
Yeah, I'm going to go there anyway, you know. And he's also egged on by his cousin Benjamin, who features in our story as well.
Uh-huh.
I like that, you know, Benjamin is a little bit braver than Peter, or he's perceived to be a bit braver. But actually, you know, I made him, like, you know, scarper in the end and leave Peter on his own. But I do feel, doing work for young under fives, that I also have a responsibility to be not just promoting great stories, but, like... good messages as well. And so Mr. McGregor, we have this sort of resolution at the end between him and Peter, you know, where they have an exchange that's kind and that's lovely, and it kind of, it completes it really
nicely.
It's
where you want things to end up.
Yeah, right? You know, you don't, you know, if only Peter had asked if he could have my vegetables, you know, because actually it's quite annoying if you're growing vegetables and the little rabbit just comes and steals them. You know, that I would chase a rabbit round with a rake.
Well,
I wouldn't, but, you know, he does. So it's quite...
Well, that's a message about curiosity, huh, Annie, that, you know, you don't want to abandon your curiosity, but you don't want to just go grabbing every vegetable that you want to grab, right?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I'm just thinking about, you know, curiosity is... it's what moves us through life and what makes us you know, smart are I think it's an innate thing. You want to know what's going on over there. I want to learn that. What's that? I think if you don't have curiosity, then how are you going to progress?
Sometimes the arc of life can diminish our curiosity, though. I mean, it's strongest in those under fives that you're reaching out to, but
yeah.
It seems so sad when that kind of wanes over time.
Yeah, you know, we're born with this curiosity. Infants, I mean, look at a baby, even they're like, they reach for something and they want to
know everything.
See what's in that box. And, you know, it's a beautiful thing.
I wonder if it does
diminish completely. I'm so curious. Yeah, maybe not as curious.
Oh, sure you are. But, you know, you also, Annie, you're in the business of giving people their first theatrical experience. So you might even be able to contribute to the development of that or the kind of continuation of that curiosity, don't you think?
I think so. And that's what is such a beautiful responsibility. And there, you know, there is a bit in the play where we have to say to the teachers, you know, the kids will get a little bit excited, you know, because the kids do stand up and clap and jump up and down. And but it's okay, because that's just them being their part. They become part of it. And they really want to. Yeah, they want. Actually, I wonder if they want Peter to. They do. They want Peter to say sorry. That's what they said. One little kid said, say sorry.
That's a good message,
him.
Annie.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, have a lovely birthday, guys.
Annie Wood Cusick is a playwright and director whose latest production is Peter Rabbit and the Garden, adapted from Beatrix Potter's stories. It's a world premiere production of the Honolulu Theater for Youth. Details about it can be found on our HPR2.org website.
Why do you like the taste of one wine over another? Perhaps it's because some expert convinced you. I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for the psychology of wine tasting, plus how big data can help you find the best burger, and a simple solution stimulates stem cells. All on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
Hawaii Public Radio salutes its dedicated station members. The station's business model is an unlikely one, and your personal commitment is proof positive that it's one that can work. We gratefully acknowledge Melvin and Ruth Yoshioka of Mililani, Leslie Gies of Kula, and Hillary Parker of Kula for your recent gifts. We're proud to count you among HPR's growing family of members. Now join the people who are making a difference every day. Follow the support link at hpr2.org. For a while there, it looked like Hawaii might be moving toward decriminalizing marijuana, but now it seems that we'll have to wait for another day, likely in another year. The Senate bill tanked yesterday. Throughout the process, Cheech and Chong have been paying attention to the Hawaii legislature and giving advice for submitting testimony. But might that have hindered and not helped the process? It's a question Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair is asking. And he joins us this morning for today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Beth Ann.
So he has been, well, Cheech and Chong, both of them have been logging onto their website with tips and, you know, suggestions for submitting testimony. Really not something that would be unexpected given the ties that at least Chong has to this community, right?
Right, exactly. And I'm not sure whether Cheech and Chong actually blogged that information themselves or had somebody do that for them. I think the important point, though, is that while the two Senate panels killed a bill to legalize marijuana, another Senate panel actually advanced a measure to decriminalize. And, I mean, they're different things. Legalize would be like what Washington and Colorado did, decriminalize would be allowing a small amount, less than an ounce of marijuana, for example, to be used for personal use. If you get caught with it, the current legislation would be a $100 penalty. There would be no prison time. So even though we did not move on legalization, we are looking at decriminalization, possibly.
Although to legalize would be the ultimate decriminalization, wouldn't it?
Yes, yes, it would. And sometimes the terms are used interchangeably. The police departments, for example, that testified against the bill, they said decriminalization really is de facto legalization. But the Senate panel voted unanimously to move the bill forward. It now goes to Senator Clayton Hee's Judiciary and Labor Committee. Senator Hee has actually pushed decriminalization legislation in the past. So who knows? Maybe I hesitate to say which way this bill is going to go, but for now, it is moving forward.
When the session opened last month and Speaker Suki was talking about you know, allowing the proposed state's medical marijuana dispensaries to actually take root and be able to actually do what they're supposed to do, and we haven't even gotten to that point yet.
That's right, and I should point out that decriminalization legislation has died in the past in the House, but with Speaker Suki indicating at least support for medical marijuana dispensaries, one wonders if opinions are changing, as they seem to be across the country when it comes to marijuana, reforming marijuana laws.
And the point that maybe we want to watch what happens in other places before we make the same steps here.
Exactly.
All right, Chad, have a good weekend.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
We'll talk to you on Monday. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com. On a Friday, we get the chance to sit down and talk with HPR's news director, Bill Norman, and find out what the news department has in store for us in the coming week. Good morning and happy Valentine's Day.
Good morning, Beth Ann, and happy Valentine's Day indeed. You know, on Valentine's Day, it's always sort of that period of time for any sports fans out there. It's kind of, well, football season really is over. But it's a shift over to basketball for some people, and there is a basketball tournament that's going to be taking place this coming week that is like no other here on Oahu. Well, it's called the All Mike Tournament, as in All Micronesian.
Uh-huh.
It's the third year for this tournament. It's held down at the Palama Settlement here on Oahu. Started in reaction to Medicare cuts that Micronesians faced several years ago. It's grown to become something much, much bigger. It's one of those events that helps build a community among some of the newest immigrants to Hawaii, but also allows for a broader identity. In Hawaii, a lot of people sometimes know a bit about the Compact of Free Association between the U.S., Marshall Islands, Palau, and the Federated States of Micronesia. This goes back to 1986, and actually its roots go back to the nuclear testing that the U.S. did in the years after World War II and following. It allows citizens of member states to live and work in the U.S. and allows the U.S. military to operate freely in those areas and to also restrict the militaries of other countries. At any rate, sometimes there is a tendency to lump all Micronesians together as just this one group of people, and it's very different. So someone from Chuuk, someone from Yap, someone from Marshall Islands, there's a differentiation level that a lot of times gets lost. This basketball tournament is a chance to allow not only a coming together for the broader community, but also for a sense of those individualized identities within that broader community. And there's a lot more in terms of a lot of the challenges that are faced by Micronesians here, and a lot of misunderstandings in terms of, I don't want to say the media at large, but just people generally don't. There are a lot of points of distinction that within this world. So Molly Solomon is going to be following that next week, and is going to have a lot more on that.
You mentioned, you know, here we are at Valentine's Day, and the session started last month. We're already moving toward its recess.
Yeah.
And then, but then we're going to have crossover. I mean, it's just moving along.
Exactly. You know, you were talking earlier about calendars and anniversaries. Happy happy anniversary on the show itself and the conversation.
Thank you.
But that does, you know, how a bill becomes a law sort of grinds right on. And next week does come that that recess. Chance for lawmakers to review the bills. It doesn't mean that everything grinds to a total halt. So for example, the Senate Human Services Committee is going to be getting an update on affordable housing projects, those that have been completed, those that are underway, those that are still in the planning stages. And the focus here is on housing units for people making 80% or below of what's called the average median income. In the city and county of Honolulu, that's a little under $63,000 for a two-person household, about $55,000 for a one-person household. We're going to be hearing from a series of agencies involved in this, and Wayne Yoshioka will be covering that.
Yeah, we'll be looking forward to all of that and more,
oh,
as
you
they
bet.
Say in
you
certain
bet.
Circles. Thanks so much, and
thanks.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you, too.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
This morning feeling fine. There's something special on my mind. Last night I met a new boy in the neighborhood. Oh yeah. Something tells me I'm into something good.
Something tells me I'm into something.
And this could be a little something good for you too, because it couldn't be Valentine's Day without chocolate. Well, unless, of course, maybe you're allergic to it. But if you're not, manufacturers of Hawaii chocolate are hoping that their wares will be your pick. But just how much Hawaii chocolate is there to go around? Some have talked about the beginnings of an island chocolate industry. Others are still laughing at that last word. We thought we'd ask Nat Blettler. He's the co-founder of Madre Chocolates, recently expanded from its original location in Kailua to a second one in Chinatown. And even though he's having a very busy day today, he's on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann. How are you? Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. So this whole idea that we've been kind of dancing around for a little while now is we've seen, you know, chocolate, very boutique-type chocolates emerge from specialty shops around Hawaii. Do we really have an industry yet?
Yeah, it's really booming. We've seen it grow about two times every year for the past 3 years that we've been in existence. And it's definitely very new. Although Hershey's started growing cacao in Puna on the Big Island in the early 1900s, it was really a false start, and it didn't take off till the 90s. The 1990s, when more was planted in Kona, and then that we're almost on the third wave, so maybe we'll get it right on the third try now, where people are planting already about 65 acres, and it's predicted that sometime this year there'll probably be over 100 acres of cacao growing in Hawaii.
Now, the Hawaii Chocolate and Cacao Association has been, you know, diligently moving to make this more of an industry as opposed to just boutique production. How effective has that been in being able to raise our awareness of Hawaii chocolate?
It's been excellent. We have a conference every year. We're having it next Sunday, so just in about 9 days, and every year that seems to double with new farmers who are interested from all the different islands. And we talk about a lot of the pertinent issues, like what's the best soils and rainfall and wind to plant cacao in Hawaii. And probably one of the most important things for growing excellent cacao in Hawaii is the fermentation of the cacao. Not everyone realizes that chocolate is a fermented food, but it is, and that fermentation actually adds about, I say, 75% of the flavor to the chocolate.
So
and
let's
the
talk.
Chocolate makers have been. Go ahead.
No, Nat, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think you're right that most people don't associate the word fermentation with chocolate. So right. what happens from the time, like, just sort of take us through a little bit of a journey of, okay, once you've got the cacao, then what?
So you pick the beautiful fresh orange and red and yellow pods off the tree. You crack them open, and inside is this white flesh that surrounds the cacao seeds that taste nothing like chocolate. It tastes like lychee or mangosteen, or some people say lemon curd. And the sugars in that fruit fuel the ferment of the cacao, and you put those white seeds in a pile or in a wood bin, or in Hawaii we actually have to put it in an insulator, like a cooler often, to keep the temperatures up, because we're in what we like to call the North Pole of cacao. We're the coldest place on the planet where cacao grows, and that can be a problem, and just that the fermentation becomes a little bit difficult to keep up the temperatures. You know, like a good kimchi or a beer or wine, you need to keep it at the perfect temperature for the yeast. But if you do it right, you can get these incredible fruit flavors in the chocolate that you don't find anywhere else in from cacao around the world. You know, we've had cacao from Venezuela that tastes like nutmeg, and from Indonesia that tastes like hazelnuts, and from
I'm over the moon now.
But the Hawaiian stuff tastes like tropical fruit, like pineapples and guanabana, and all these incredible flavors that you don't see anywhere else. So if you do it right, we can make Hawaiian cacao and chocolate a unique flavor. And that can justify the higher costs and difficulties of growing the cacao and making the chocolate here.
So in that fermentation process, that's when all that dark richness starts to happen? I mean, to take the white flesh and have it turn into that deep, dark, beautiful, wonderful stuff that now I can only dream about because I'm sitting here in the studio?
I'm sorry, we didn't get to bring you any samples beforehand.
No, that's it's hard to do that through the phone, and certainly We're not blaming you for that one, but really, when you look at the Hawaiian chocolate and how Hawaii has a very, as you say, unique position in all of the other flavors of chocolate, is that something that the rest of the world is beginning to appreciate? Are you doing a lot of export?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we send chocolate, you know, all around Oahu, to the other islands, to the many cities on the mainland, to Australia, Japan, Sweden, Germany, Holland, England, even Belgium is demanding the Hawaiian chocolate.
And
like
what
ours,
and what do the folks in Belgium have to say about our chocolate, considering that that's the chocolate capital, or so we're told?
They love it. We actually had a Belgian intern for a while 2 years ago who was trying to convince us in the world that Belgium was not the capital of chocolate, that it was actually Hawaii. Because we have this perfect combo in Hawaii where we have the chocolate maker right next to the cacao grower, and they're even often the same person. And that allows you to speed up the development cycle. So we can make a chocolate and give it back to the cacao grower within about a month of them giving us the beans. So we can say, hey, whatever you did with that ferment, the way you stirred it, or the box that you put it in, it was great. It produced this incredible cacao. Keep doing that. Or, you know, maybe try adding this fertilizer or this different yeast to the ferment and see what happens.
So it sounds like you're all... Excuse me for interrupting you, Nat, but we're going to have to go into a second. It seems like you're all a really tightly knit group. Do you have a real firm number of how much chocolate Hawaii produced last year?
That's a hard question to answer because not everyone is part of the HCCA. But I'd say it was probably a few tons. So that's a couple 100,000 chocolate bars to make your mouth water even more. But you should come all down to our shop in Chinatown or Kailua and
settle for just
bars
one
that we're making today.
And I'm sure they'll be flying out given that today's Valentine's Day. Thanks for taking a little time from all the stuff you have to do to make sure that those who want the chocolate can get it today. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
And have a happy Valentine's Day.
My pleasure, Stephanie. You too, and happy birthday.
Thank you so much. Nat Lettler is one of the co-founders of Madre Chocolates. started in Kailua and recently opened in Chinatown. The link to all the deliciousness is on hpr2.org.
Earlier in the show, we asked you about our very first program 3 years ago today. It was a Monday, and love was very much on our minds, it being Valentine's Day. This morning, we asked if you could tell us any of the topics that helped kick off the conversation. Back in 2011, we were still talking about civil unions, and we called one Big Island couple to get their take. We also called the UH Condom Fair, did a little mental soul surfing about the real thing, and the Hot Club of Hoolaville came in to wish us well and play a little music. If you named any of these conversations, you are our Valentine, because you are obviously listening on that Monday morning and have good recall. Better than mine, it's 8:47, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Karen Meyer from Manoa Valley Theater. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Cupid, draw back your bow and let your arrow go straight to my lover's heart. For me.
With all this love in the air, our thoughts turn to the many ways people can express it. And as many families know, one of the most enduring is one of the most simple, reading aloud to a child. In our fondest memories of parents, we think of their voices as they read stories to us when we're little. Read Aloud America is a Hawaii organization that's looking for volunteers around the state to take part in a new program, and Joanne Laird, program director, is on the phone with us from Maui. Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
I'm sure you've seen through years of experience just what kind of effect it has when you start reading aloud in a family.
Amazing. Our program has been in existence since 1996, mm-hmm. and the statistics and the data show that reading aloud definitely changes the family and students' performance at school.
Sure, I would think it would. It just, for one thing, it just fosters an appreciation, right?
It does, an appreciation and a love for reading and being read to, and which transfers over into the classroom.
Well, you know, Joanne, the world of reading requires that we create pictures in our minds, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And that's a little bit different from the total immersion that you sometimes get in contemporary media, where kind of everything is shown, displayed, there's music, there's sound. There's not that much for you to do in that kind of media, don't you think?
That is correct. You need to trigger the imaginations, and the best way to do that is to read your child a story so that the child can picture what's happening in their mind instead of on a screen device.
Well, you kind of see in kids' faces when they're in front of something like that that there's a disturbingly passive look that I sometimes see.
Oh, absolutely. Not only children, but adults, too.
Yeah, I shouldn't exempt adults from
right.
that. But, you know, I'm going to take an educated guess, Joanne, that a lot of the people who got this program, got Read Aloud America going in the first place, had their own childhood memories of having been read to and felt that they benefited from it.
That is correct. Jed Gaines, our founder and president, started the program 15 years ago. We cannot believe it's been 15 years.
Yeah.
But he was dyslexic, and having somebody read to him and then he reading aloud to his child really made a difference in the youngster's life. So and then he started volunteering at a school, and then that's how the whole program evolved.
So he had he would not have been able to read to himself, or not effectively.
That is correct. And when he was reading to his daughter, he remembers having to struggle, you know, with the words. And it was kind of a learning process for both Jed and his daughter.
Sure, I would imagine. And and the kind of thing in a different environment, it might have turned him away from reading altogether.
That's right. But then when he started going to the schools and forcing himself to read aloud to other children, he realized that, you know, reading aloud not only helps the speaker, but it also helps the listener. And so that's how it all came about. And now that we are 15 years into the program and with 142 programs under our belt, the statistic that we get from the parents lets us know that it changes their lives at home, too, when they read to their children.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt that. And Joanne, you're recruiting volunteers for a new program, yeah?
Well, we have three programs that are just started this week on Oahu. We are the recipient of a Honolulu City grant.
Oh.
So we went from one program on Oahu with limited funds to three all of a sudden. And so, yes, we are in need of volunteer readers. And the volunteer readers are provided with an in-service and training and all the books. And they are asked to read aloud to a grade level at our six programs. And it's a lot of fun.
So all you would need to take part is you just got to be able to read, right?
That's right. And we provide all the materials for them. Every time they come to a program, there's a reader bag. We do picture books from kindergarten to grade two, and then chapter books from then on, and we provide everything.
Joanne, what are some of the, in the books that you provide, I mean, you folks have obviously given some thought to what makes good read-aloud reading for different age groups. What are some of the choices that you guys have made about material over the years?
We work with the librarians in the public library. That's how we got our original read-aloud books. And we always are evolving and adding new books. But, you know, the children's librarians at our public libraries are really the best, a very, very good resource for what is good quality material that appeals to both boys and girls.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we are reading The Sea of Monsters, which is a Rick Riordan book, to our fifth graders. And there's an action and adventure, but enough to keep both the boys and girls, you know, listening and leaning forward and to find out what's happening next.
The Sea of Monsters, did you say?
That is correct. It's a whole series. It's called The Lightning Thief and the Percy Jackson series, and it's based on Greek mythology, believe it or not. So there's a learning part of it, too.
That's great.
As well as being entertaining.
Well, and you know, when you refer to Greek mythology, of course, a lot of us grew up with those stories. And, you know, by the time you get through the Minotaur and the Cyclops with the eye in the middle of his forehead, I mean, it's a pretty good source of stories, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, there are stories here in Hawaii that are also just as exciting.
Oh, yeah.
Just last night, we had a program here on Maui, and one of our Maui, what we call, she's a kind of a professional, Kathy Collins, she read aloud a children's storybook written by a Hawaiian for children, and she read it to the parents to model how to read aloud to their kids.
Uh-huh.
Amazing. So exciting, and the parents just loved it.
What are some things you can pass along to model reading aloud to? How did she do it? What did she do?
Well, you know, Kathy is a professional actress and a writer, and so she's the one up there just, you know, emoting with the name of the book was The Hungry and the Sweet, Sweet Potato, and it had a message about sharing. And she went, you know, kind of went into some voices, but we tell the parents you don't have to be professional to read aloud to your children.
Mm-hmm.
They just, as you stated in your introduction, it's the power of the parent's voice that is so lasting. I know I read aloud to my daughter. She's 34 years old now, and she remembers Goodnight Moon like it was yesterday.
See, that that tells you an awful lot right there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's what, as a parent presenter trainer, we do have parent presenters that basically are the MCs for the program, and they share a little bit of what we call the seminar on, you know, what to do and how to read aloud to your kids and one-on-one and snuggling in bed with your child with a book. And it's we give them tips so that they can do it at home and they don't have to be a professional.
Do some of them coming into the program, the parents indicate to you they were a little hesitant?
Absolutely. They're especially the men. They're afraid we're going to ask them questions. And read aloud is all about fun. There's no questions. And parents do write an evaluation every evening. And if they have any questions, they put them on the evaluation. And then the next session, we answer them for them with no names. And last night, I know we had a program on Maui and on Hilo. And both Jed Gaines and I'm a presenter as well. We answered all the questions that they asked from the previous session about, you know, well, what should I ask my kids questions about what I'm reading? No.
Well, Joanne, we will steer some people your way. Thanks very much for talking with us this morning. Joanne Laird is the program director for Read Aloud America, which is recruiting volunteers for a fall Read Aloud program in Hawaii schools. And you can find out how to sign up by going to our HPR2 website.
Are you a sustaining member of Hawaii Public Radio? If so, Beijing may be closer than you think. All current sustaining members are automatically entered into HPR's Beijing is Closer Than You Think sweepstakes. Sustaining membership is an easy, ongoing monthly giving plan that helps HPR plan for the future. To become a sustaining member, call 955-8821 during business hours. No donation is required to enter the sweepstakes. See complete rules at hawaiipublicradio.org/Beijing. And thanks.
And we thank you for loyally soldiering on with us over these last 3 years as we are celebrating our third anniversary. And especially to you, Chris Vandercook.
My been fun,
partner
hasn't
in
it?
Crime over the last 3 years. We've been having a good time. Let's move on to year four. And coming up next week, Monday is President's Day. Some say lumping a day to honor all presidents, great and not so stellar, dilutes the original intent of the honor paid to Lincoln and Washington. HPU Professor David Lanui will be here to talk about the presidential holiday.
And how Hawaii travelers can become agents of social change through crowdsourcing.
Meanwhile, let us in on your radio talkback. You can sound off on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, tweet us at HI Conversation, or me at BecauseHPR, or you can even email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our production assistant. And Kapi'olani Ching is our intern.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Have a happy, safe, and wonderful Valentine's Day. And we will see you on Monday when we pick up the conversation.